Lana, for the better part of a year, was just leaving the nurse's station for a coffee break, and she suggested I tag along. Chapter 13. On our way down the hall to the staff lounge, I asked her a few questions, trying to get a feel for the kind of person she was. She told me she was born and raised in Santa Teresa, that she'd been at Sunrise House for 3 years, and she liked it okay. Effusive was not an adjective I'd have been tempted to apply. Her dark hair was thin, with layers of drooping ringlets that looked dispirited. Already, I wanted her to fire her stylist and try someone new. Her eyes were dark, and the whites were bloodshot, as though she were trying her first contact lenses without much success. The staff lounge was small but attractively furnished. There was a table with chairs drawn up to it, a modern couch, and two upholstered love seats arranged around a coffee table. A microwave oven, a toaster oven, and a coffee maker sat on the counter. The refrigerator was decorated with stern warnings about the sanctity of other employees' food. I took a seat at the table while Lana poured coffee in a mug and added 2 packs of Cremora and 2 of Sweet and Low.
You want coffee?
No, thanks, I'm fine. She picked up a tray and carried it to the vending machine, where she put numerous coins in the slot. She punched a button, and I watched her selection tumble into the bin below. She brought her tray to the table and offloaded her coffee mug, her spoon, and a package of miniature chocolate-covered donuts. I waited until she was seated before I went on. How long have you known Solana? She broke the first donut in 2 and popped half in her mouth.
What's the job?
The question was a bit abrupt, but in the interest of priming the pump, I filled her in. My next-door neighbor fell and dislocated his shoulder. He's 89 and needs home care while he recuperates.
So, what'd she make?
The donut looked dense and dry, and the dark chocolate frosting had the gloss of wax. For 10 cents, I'd have knocked her down and eaten one myself. I knew now that the many fruits and vegetables I'd consumed over the past few days had only made me hostile, not good in my line of work. For an instant, I'd completely lost my place in the conversation.
What? What's the pay?
I don't know. I was asked to talk to people who've worked with her. I'm interested in a character reference.
In the neighborhood.
I won't be talking to her neighbors unless I bomb out every place else.
I'm talking salary.
Ballpark. What's the hourly wage?
No one's mentioned it. Are you thinking about changing jobs? I might be.
The second donut was gone, though I'd hardly noticed, distracted as I was by the opening I saw. If things don't work out for her, I'd be happy to throw your name in the hat.
I'd consider it, she said. Remind me before you leave, and I'll give you my resume. I have a copy in my purse.
Great. I'll pass it along, I said, and then shifted the conversation. Were you and Solana friends?
I wouldn't say we were friends, but we worked together for close to a year, and we got along all right.
What's she like? She shrugged.
So-so.
So-so?
Well, I guess she's nice enough if you like that kind.
Ah, and what kind is that?
Fussy. If anyone was even 2 minutes late, she made a big deal of it.
So she was punctual, I suggested.
Well, yeah, if that's what you want to call it.
What about personal traits?
Like what?
Was she patient, compassionate, honest, good-natured?
That's the kind of thing I'm looking for.
You must have had many opportunities to observe her firsthand. She stirred her coffee, then licked the spoon clean before she laid it on her tray. She put the next donut in her mouth whole and chewed while she considered her reply.
You want my honest opinion?
I would love it.
Don't get me wrong. I have nothing against the woman, but she had no sense of humor, and she wasn't that good a conversationalist. I mean, you say something to her, and maybe she'd answer, and maybe not, depending on what suited her. She was all the time sitting with her nose in a chart or out on the floor checking on the patients. Wasn't even her responsibility. She took it on herself.
I said, wow, I had no idea. On paper, she looks good.
That's seldom the whole story. And that's exactly why I'm here, to fill in the blanks. Did you see her outside work? Hardly. The rest of us, sometimes on Friday nights, we'd go out together, kind of letting our hair down at the end of the week. So Lana went straight home. After a while, we didn't even ask her to join us because we figured she'd say no. She didn't drink. Nuh-uh. Are you kidding? She was too uptight. Plus, she was always watching her weight. And on her breaks, she read books. Anything to make the rest of us look bad. Does that help? Enormously. You think she'll be hired? Well, it's not up to me. But I'm certainly going to make a note of what you've said. I left the place at 1 o'clock p.m. with Lana Sherman's resume in hand. Walking back to the office, I passed a sandwich shop and realized I hadn't had lunch. In the press of work, I've been known to skip meals, but seldom when I was this hungry. I noticed that eating properly was antithetical to feeling full. A QP with cheese and a large serving of fries will leave you close to comatose. The sudden onslaught of carbohydrates and fat makes you long for a nap, which means a gap of 10 or 15 minutes before you start thinking about your next meal. I did an about-face and veered into the sandwich shop. What I ordered is none of your business, but it was really good. I ate at my desk while I reviewed the Fredrickson file. At 2 o'clock, clipboard in hand, I arrived for my appointment with Gladys Fredrickson. She and her husband lived in a modest house near the beach, on a street being overtaken by much grander homes. Given the exaggerated prices of local real estate, it made sense for buyers to snap up any house for sale and do extensive remodeling on the existing residence or raise the entire structure and start from scratch. The Fredrickson's one-story frame house fit the latter category. Not so much a fixer-upper as something you'd bulldoze, pile in a heap, and burn. There was a shabbiness about the place that suggested years of deferred maintenance. Along the side of the house, I could see that a strip of aluminum gutter had come loose. Below the gap, a clump of rotting leaves lay fallen in a makeshift compost heap. I suspected the carpet would smell damp and the grout between the shower tiles would be black with mildew. In addition to the wooden porch stairs, there was a long wooden ramp that extended from the drive to the porch to allow wheelchair access. The ramp itself was mottled with dark green algae and doubtless became as slick as glass whenever it rained. I stood on the porch looking down at the ivy beds interspersed with yellow blooms of oxalis. Inside, the dog was yapping at a rate that would probably net him a swat on his butt. Across the side yard, through a chicken wire fence, I caught sight of an elderly neighbor lady setting out what were probably the annual Christmas decorations on her lawn. These consisted of 7 hollow plastic Santa's helpers that could be lighted from inside. Also 9 plastic reindeer, one of which had a big red nose. She paused to stare at me, and my quick wave was rewarded with a smile laced with sweetness and pain. There had once been little ones, children or grandchildren, whose memory she celebrated with this steadfast display of hope. I'd already knocked twice, and I was on the verge of knocking again when Gladys opened the door, leaning heavily on a walker, her neck encircled by a 6-inch foam collar. She was tall and thick, the buttons of her plaid blouse gaping open across her ample breasts. The elastic waist on her rayon pants had given way, and she'd used 2 large safety pins to affix the trousers to her shirt, thus preventing them from dropping and pooling around her ankles. She wore a pair of off-brand running shoes, though it was clear she wouldn't be running any time soon. On her left foot, a half moon of leather had been cut away to provide relief for her bunion.
Yes?
I'm Kinsey Milhone, Mrs. Fredrickson. We have an appointment to talk about the accident.
You're with the insurance company?
Not yours. I'm working with California Fidelity Insurance. I was hired by Lisa Ray's attorney.
Accident was her fault?
So I've been told. I'm here to verify the information she gave us.
Oh, well, I guess you better come on in, she said,
already turning her walker so she could hump her way back to the Lazy Boy where she'd been sitting. As I closed the door, I noticed a collapsible wheelchair
propped up against the wall. I'd been wrong about the carpet. Theirs had been removed, revealing narrow plank hardwood floors. Staples that once held the padding in place were still embedded in the wood, and I could see a line of dark holes where the tack strips had been nailed. The interior of the house was so dense with heat that the air smelled scorched. A small, brightly colored bird was fanning its way like a moth from one drapery panel to the next, while the dog pranced across the sofa cushions, toppling the stacks of magazines, junk mail, bills, and newspapers piled along the length. The dog had a small face, bright black eyes, and a poofy cravat of hair spilling across its chest. The bird had left two white poker chips of poop on the floor between the end table and the chair. Gladys hollered,
"Millard! I told you to get that dog out of here! Dixie's up on the couch, and I can't be responsible for what she does next." "God damn it, I'm coming. Quit your hollering," Millard called from somewhere down the narrow hall.
Dixie was still barking, dancing on her hind legs, with her dainty front feet pawing the air, her eyes fixed on the parakeet, hopeful that she would be rewarded for her trick by getting to eat the bird. A moment later, Millard appeared, propelling his wheelchair into view. Like Gladys, I judged him to be in his early 60s, though he was aging better than she. He was a heavy-set man with a ruddy face, a thick black mustache, and a head of curly gray hair. He whistled sharply for the dog, and she hopped off the sofa, crossed the room rapidly, and leaped onto his lap. He did a rolling pivot and disappeared down the hall, grumbling as he went. "How long has your husband used a chair?"
8 years. We had to have the carpet taken up so he can manage from room to room.
I'm hoping he's made time for me today. As long as I'm here, I can talk to him as well.
No, now he said it didn't suit him. You'll have to come back another time if you want to talk to him.
Gladys shoved aside a pile of papers.
Make a space for yourself if you care to sit.
I perched gingerly in the clearing she'd made. I set my shoulder bag on the floor and removed my tape recorder, which I placed on the coffee table in front of me. A tower of manila envelopes tilted against my thigh, most by way of a courier service called Fleet Feet. I waited while she maneuvered herself into position and then eased into the recliner with a grunt. During that brief delay, purely in the interest of securing the avalanche of bills, I did fan out the first 5 or 6 envelopes. 2 had red rims and a hoary warning that read, "Urgent, final notice." 1 was for a gasoline credit card, the other from a department store chain. Once Gladys was settled, I tried on my visiting nurse voice. "I'll be recording this with your permission. Is that agreeable to you?"
"I suppose."
After I pressed the record button, I recited my name, her name, the date, and the case number. "Just for the record, you're giving this information voluntarily without threats or coercion, is that correct?"
"I said I would."
"Thank you. I appreciate that. In answering my questions, please respond only with the facts within your knowledge. I'd ask you to avoid opinions, judgments, or conclusions."
"Well, I've got my opinions like everyone else."
"I understand that, Mrs. Fredrickson, but I have to limit my report to information as accurate as you can make it. If I ask a question and you don't know or don't remember, just say so. Please don't guess or speculate. Are you ready to proceed?"
"I've been ready since I sat down. You're the one dragging it out. I didn't expect all this claptrap and falderall."
"I appreciate your patience." She nodded in response, but before I could formulate the first question, she launched into an account of her own.
"Oh, hon, I'm a wreck. No pun intended. I can't hardly get around without my walker. I got numbness and tingling in this foot. Feels like it's fell asleep, like I've been laying on it wrong."
She went on describing the pains in her leg, while I sat and took notes, doing a proper job of it. "Anything else?" I asked.
"Well, headaches, of course. And my neck's all froze up. Look at this. I can't hardly turn my head. That's why I got this collar here, to help give support."
"Any other pain?"
"Honey, pain's all I've got."
May I ask what medications you're taking?
I got a pill for everything.
She reached over to the end table, where a number of prescription bottles had been assembled, along with a glass of water. She picked up the vials one by one, holding them out so I could write down the names.
These two are pain pills. This one's a muscle relaxant, and this here's for depression.
I was scribbling away, but looked up with interest.
Depression? I got chronic depression. I can't remember when I've ever felt so low. Dr. Goldfarb, the orthopedic specialist, he sent me to see this psychiatrist who put me on these new pills. I guess the other ones don't do much once you've taken them a while.
I made a note of the prescription for Elavil that she'd held out for my inspection. And what were you on before?
Lithium.
Have you had other problems since the accident?
Poor sleep, and I can't hardly work a lick. He said I might not ever be able to work again. Not even permanent part-time.
I understand you do the bookkeeping for a number of small businesses.
The past 42 years. Talk about a job that gets old. I've about had it with that stuff.
You have an office in your home?
She nodded toward the hall. Second bedroom back there. Thing is, I can't sit for long on account of my hip gives me fits. You ought to see the big old bruise I had, all up and down this side, purple as an eggplant. I still got a patch of yellow as big as the moon. And hurt? Oh, my stars! I had tape on these here ribs, and then, like I said, I have this problem with my neck, whiplash and all, and a concussion of the head. I call that confusion contusions, she said, and barked out a laugh.
I smiled politely. What kind of car do you drive?
1976 Ford van, dark green, in case you mean to ask that next.
Thank you, I said, and made a note. Let's go back to the accident. Would you tell me what happened?
Be happy to, though it was a terrible, terrible thing for me, as you might imagine.
She narrowed her eyes and tapped a finger against her lips, looking into the middle distance as though reciting a poem. By the time she was halfway through the second sentence, it was clear she'd told the story so often that the details wouldn't vary.
Millard and me were driving along Palisade Drive up by the City College. This was Thursday of Memorial Day weekend. What is that, 6 or 8 months back?
About that. What time of day was this?
Middle of the afternoon.
What about weather conditions? She frowned slightly, forced to think about her answer instead of offering up her usual rote response.
Fine, as near as I remember. We'd had rains off and on all last spring, but a dry spell come along, and the papers was saying the weekend would be nice.
And which direction were you heading?
Toward downtown. You couldn't have been driving more than 5 or 6 miles an hour. Might have been a bit more, but it was way under the posted limit. I'm positive about that.
And that's 25 miles an hour.
Something along those lines.
Can you remember how far away Mrs. Ray's vehicle was when you first noticed it?
I remember she was over to my right in that entrance to the parking lot up at the City College. Millard was just about passing when she come flying out in front of me. Boom! He slammed on the brakes, but not near quick enough. I was never so surprised in my life, and that's the truth.
Was her left turn signal blinking?
I don't believe it was. I'm not sure.
What about your turn signal?
No, ma'am. He didn't intend to turn. We were fixing to continue on down the hill to Castle.
I believe there was some question about your seatbelt. She shook her head emphatically.
I never ride in a car without a seatbelt. It might have come loose on impact, but I was wearing one for sure.
I took a moment to review my notes, wondering if there was any way to throw her off her stride. The well-rehearsed data was getting old. Where were you going? That stumped her. She blinked and said,
Where?
I'm wondering where the two of you were going when the accident occurred. I'm filling in the blanks. I held up my clipboard as though that explained everything.
I forget.
You don't remember where you were going?
I just said that. You told me to say so if I couldn't remember, and I can't.
Fine. That's exactly right. I stared at my clipboard and made a mark. If it would help refresh your memory, could you have been heading for the freeway? From Castle, you can take the north or southbound on-ramps. Gladys shook her head. Ever since the accident, my memory shot. Were you running errands? Grocery shopping? Something for dinner, perhaps? Must have been errands. I'd say errands. You know, I might have amnesia. Doctors say it's not uncommon in accidents of this type. I can't hardly concentrate. That's why I can't work. I can't sit and I can't think. Work I do. That's all it is, except for add and subtract and stamping envelopes. I looked down at my notes. You mentioned a concussion. Oh, I banged my head good. On what? Windshield, I guess. Might have been the windshield. I still got me a knot, she said, placing a hand briefly on the side of her head. I placed my hand on the left side of my head, as she had. On the left side up here or in back? Both. I got bumped every which way. Here, feel this. I reached forward. She clasped my hand and pressed it against a hard knot about the size of a fist. My goodness. You better make a note of it, she said, pointing at my clipboard. Absolutely, I said, scribbling on the page. What happened after that? Millard was shook up, as you might well imagine. He soon discerned he wasn't hurt, but he could see I was out like a light, knocked completely unconscious. As soon as I regained my senses, he helped me out of the van. Wasn't easy for him, since he had to get situated in his chair and lever himself down to the pavement. I couldn't hardly tell where I was at. I was all dizzy and discombobulated and shaken like a leaf. You must have been upset. Why wouldn't I be when she pulled out in front of us? Of course. Let's just see now. I paused to check my notes. Aside from you and your husband and Ms. Ray, was there anyone else at the scene? Oh, my, yes. Someone called the police, and they come pretty quick, along with the fellers in the ambulance. I'm talking about prior to their arrival. Did anyone stop to help? She shook her head. No. I don't believe so. Not that I recall. I understand that a gentleman was giving aid and assistance before the traffic officer showed up. She stared at me, blinking. Well, yes. Now you mention it. I forgot about that. While Millard was checking the van, this feller helped me over to the curb. He set me down and put his arm across my shoulders, worried I'd go into shock. That flew right out of my head until just now. This was another motorist? I believe this was someone come off the street. Can you describe the man? She seemed to hesitate. Why do you want to know? Ms. Ray was hoping to find him so she could send a thank you note. Well, she was silent for a full 15 seconds. I could see her computing the possibilities in her head. She was wily enough to realize that anyone who showed up that quickly might well have been a witness to the accident. Mrs. Fredrickson? What? Nothing about the man sticks in your mind? I wouldn't know anything about that. Millard might recall better than me. By then, this right hip was giving me so much pain, I'm surprised I was able to stand. If you had the X-ray here, I could point out the injured ribs. Dr. Goldfarb said I was lucky the crack in my hip wasn't more severe, or I'd have been laid up for good. What about his race? He's white. I wouldn't go to any other kind. I mean, the man who helped. She shook her head with a fleeting annoyance. I wasn't paying attention to much, except I was glad my leg wasn't broke. You'd have been glad, too, in my place. What age would you say? Now, I can't be answering questions like that. I'm getting all flustered and upset, and Dr. Goldfarb said that's not good. Not a bit good, he said. I continued to look at her, noting her gaze flick away from mine and back. I returned to my list of questions and chose a few that seemed neutral and non-inflammatory. In the main, she was cooperative, but I could see her patience was wearing thin. I tucked my pen in the clamp of the clipboard and reached for my shoulder bag as I got to my feet. Well, I think that's all for now. I appreciate your time. Once I type up my notes, I'll stop by and have you read the statement for accuracy. You can make any necessary corrections, and once you're satisfied it's a faithful rendering, you can give me a signature and I'll be out of your hair. As I clicked off the tape recorder, she said, I'm happy to help. All we want is what's fair, given the fault was entirely hers. Ms. Ray is interested in that as well. From the Fredricksons' house, I swung up to Palisade Drive and turned right, taking the same route Gladys had taken the day of the accident. I passed City College, eyes flicking to the entrance to the parking lot. I followed the road as it curved down the hill. Where Palisade intersected Castle, I took a left and followed it as far as Capillo, where I turned right. Street traffic was moving freely, and it took me less than 5 minutes to reach the office. The sky was cloudy, and there was talk of isolated thunderstorms, which I thought unlikely. For reasons I've never wholly understood, Santa Teresa has a rainy season, but seldom any thunderstorms. Lightning is a phenomenon I've witnessed largely by way of black and white photographs, showing white threads lying flat against the night sky, like irregular cracks in glass. Once I was back in the office, I set up a file and then typed my notes. I put Lana Sherman's resume in the folder with Solana Rojas's application. I could have tossed it, but why not hang on to it since I had it in hand? Wednesday morning, when Melanie called, I gave her the Reader's Digest condensed version of my findings, at the end of which she said, So, she's fine. Looks that way, I said. Of course, I didn't turn over every rock in the garden. Don't worry about it. There's no point in going nuts. That's that, then. Looks like it's working out as planned. I'll have Henry keep an eye on the situation, and if anything comes up, I can let you know. Thanks. I appreciate your help. I hung up feeling satisfied with the job I'd done. What I had no way of knowing was that I just unwittingly put a noose around Gus Vronsky's neck. Chapter 14. Christmas and New Year's Day slid past, leaving scarcely a wrinkle in the fabric of ordinary life. Charlotte was off in Phoenix, celebrating the holidays with her kids and grandkids. Henry and I spent Christmas morning together and exchanged gifts. He gave me a pedometer and a Sony headset so I could listen to the radio while I did my morning jog. For him, I'd found an antique egg timer, 6 inches tall, an ingenious glass and tin device with pink sand inside. To activate it, you flipped up the 3-minute timer until it rested against a lever at the top. Once the sand finished falling from the top portion to the bottom, the upper portion tipped over and rang a tiny bell. I also gave him a copy of Bernard Clayton's new complete book of breads. At 2 o'clock, Rosie and William joined us for Christmas dinner, after which I went back to my place and took a long holiday nap. New Year's Eve, I stayed home and read a book, happy that I wasn't out risking life and limb with the many drunks on the road. I confess I abandoned my junk food resolve on New Year's Day and enjoyed an orgy of quarter pounders with cheese, too, and a large order of fries doused in ketchup. I did keep my new pedometer affixed to my person while I ate, and I made sure I walked 10,000 steps that day, which I hoped would count in my favor. I started the first week of 1988 with a dutiful 6 a.m. 3-mile jog, radio headset in place, after which I showered and ate breakfast. At the office, I whipped out my trusty Smith Corona and composed a notice for the personal section of the Santa Teresa Dispatch, detailing my interest in the witness to a 2-vehicle collision that had occurred on Thursday, May 28, 1987, at approximately 3:15 p.m. I included the few particulars I had, listing the man's age as mid-50s, which was only a guess. Height and weight, I said, were medium, his hair thick white. I also made reference to his brown leather bomber jacket and black wingtip shoes. I didn't give my name, but I posted a contact number and an appeal for help. While I was about it, I called the Fredricksons' house, hoping to set up an appointment with Millard to discuss the accident. The phone rang countless times. I was about to put the handset back in the cradle when he picked up. Mr. Fredrickson, I'm glad I caught you. This is Kinsey Milhone. I stopped by your house and talked to your wife a couple of weeks ago. and she said I should call so I can set up an appointment with you.
I can't be bothered with this. You already talked to Gladys.
I did, and she was very helpful, I said. But there are just a couple of points I'd like to go over with you.
Like what?
I don't have my notes with me, but I can bring them when I come. Would Wednesday of this week work for you?
I'm busy.
Why don't we say next Monday? A week from today. I can be there at 2.
I'm tied up on Monday.
Why don't you name the day?
Fridays are better.
Fine. A week from this coming Friday, that's the 15th. I'll make a note on my calendar and see you at 2. Thanks so much. I marked the date and time on my calendar, relieved I wouldn't have to worry about it for another 10 days. At 9:30, I called the Santa Teresa Dispatch with the information and was told the ad would appear on Wednesday and would run for a week. Just after the accident, Mary Bellflower had placed a similar query with negative results, but I thought it was worth another try. That done, I walked over to the copy shop near the courthouse and ran off 100 flyers, describing the man and further indicating that it was hoped he had information concerning a 2-vehicle accident on such and such a date. I stapled a business card to each flyer, thinking I might pick up a client in the bargain. Aside from that, I thought it lent an earnest air to my quest. I spent most of the afternoon canvassing the hillside homes off Palisade, across the road from the entrance to Santa Teresa City College. I parked my car on a side street near a 2-story apartment complex and proceeded on foot. I must have knocked on 50 doors. When I was lucky enough to find someone at home, I explained the situation and my need to locate a witness to the accident. I underplayed the notion that he might end up testifying on behalf of the defendant. Even the most conscientious of citizens is sometimes reluctant to commit to a court appearance. Given the vagaries of the judicial system, a witness can spend hours sitting in a drafty corridor, only to be excused when opposing parties reach a pretrial settlement. After 2 hours, I'd learned absolutely nothing. Most of the residents I spoke with were unaware of the accident, and none had seen a man who matched the description of the witness I sought. If there was no response to my knock, I left a flyer in the door. I also tacked flyers to any number of telephone poles. I considered tucking a flyer under the windshield wipers of the cars I passed, but the practice is annoying, and I always toss such notices myself. I did leave a flyer taped to the wooden bench at the bus stop. It was probably illegal to use city property for such purposes, but I figured if they didn't like it, they could hunt me down and kill me. At 2:10, having covered the area, I returned to my car, drove across the intersection, and into the college parking lot. I shrugged myself into the jacket I'd tossed on the back seat, locked the Mustang, and walked out to the point where the access road emptied onto the 4-lane expanse of Palisade. A length of chain-link fence separated the eastbound from the westbound traffic. To my right, the road curved gently down along a slope and out of sight. There was no turn lane designated for vehicles intending to enter the lot from either direction, but I could see that from Lisa Ray's perspective, an oncoming vehicle would have been visible for approximately 500 yards, a fact I hadn't noted on my earlier visit. I perched on a low field stone wall and watched cars speed by. There was a smattering of foot traffic to and from the campus. Most pedestrians were students or working moms there to pick up kids from a college-run daycare facility on the far corner near the bus stop. I gathered the daycare operation had no parking spots of its own, so the moms took advantage of the city college lots when picking up their tots. Where possible, I engaged these hapless passers-by in conversation, detailing my search for the man with white hair. The moms were polite but distracted, barely responding to my questions before they hurried away, anxious to avoid being dinged with after-hours charges. As the afternoon wore on, there was a steady stream of moms with their little tykes in tow. Of the first 4 students I approached, 2 were new to the college and 2 had left town that Memorial Day weekend. A 5th wasn't even a student, just a woman out looking for her dog. None had anything useful to contribute, but I learned a lot about the intelligence and superiority of the standard poodle. The campus security officer stopped to chat, probably concerned that I was homeless, casing the joint or flogging designer drugs. While he was busy quizzing me, I quizzed him in return. He had a dim recollection of the man with white hair, but couldn't remember when he'd seen him last. At least his response, though vague, gave me a modicum of hope. I handed him a flyer and asked him to get in touch if he should spot the guy again. I continued in this manner until 5:15, 2 hours beyond the time when the accident had occurred. In May, it would have been light until 8. Now the sun set at 5. In the back of my mind, I was hoping the man had routine business that brought him to the neighborhood the same time each day. I planned to swing by again on Saturday and do a second neighborhood canvas. Weekends, I might have better luck finding folks at home. If there was no response to my newspaper ad, I'd return on Thursday of the following week. I abandoned the project for the day and headed home, feeling tired and out of sorts. In my experience, loitering is an enervating act. I turned onto my street and made the usual quick search for the parking spot closest to my studio apartment. I was puzzled to see that a bright red dumpster had been unloaded at the curb. It was easily 12 feet long and 8 feet wide, and might have served as housing for a family of five. I was forced to park around the corner and walk back. In passing, I peered over the 5-foot-high rim and into the empty interior. What was that about? I pulled the mail out of my box, went through the gate, and around the side of my studio apartment, which was once a single-car garage. 7 years before, Henry had relocated his driveway, constructed a new 2-car garage, and converted the original garage into a rental, which I'd moved into. 3 years later, an unfortunate incident with a bomb had flattened the structure. Henry had taken advantage of the free demolition, and he'd rebuilt the studio, adding a half-story that contained a sleeping loft and bath. The last dumpster I'd seen on our block was the one he rented to accommodate the construction debris. I dropped my bag inside my apartment and left the door ajar while I crossed the patio to Henry's. I rapped on his kitchen door, and he appeared moments later from his living room where he was watching the evening news. We chatted briefly about inconsequential matters, and then I said, "What's the deal with the dumpster? Is that ours?" "Gus's nurse ordered that." "Solana? That's a bold move on her part." "I thought so, too. She stopped by this morning to let me know it was being delivered. She's getting rid of Gus's junk." "You're kidding." "I'm not. She cleared it with Melanie, who gave her the go-ahead."
"And Gus agreed?"
"Looks that way. I called Melanie myself just to make sure it was legitimate. She said Gus went through a rough patch and Solana stayed 2 nights thinking he shouldn't be alone. She ended up sleeping on the couch, which was not only too short but smelled of cigarettes. She asked Melanie for permission to move in a cot, but there wasn't space for one. His second and third bedrooms are wall-to-wall junk, and that's what she intends to toss."
"I'm surprised he said yes."
"He didn't have much choice. You can't expect the woman to make up a pallet on the floor. Who's going to haul the stuff out? Must be half a ton of newspapers in that one room alone. She's doing most of it herself, at least as much as she can manage. For the bulkier items, I guess she'll hire someone. She and Gus went through everything, and he decided what he was willing to part with. He's hanging on to the good stuff, his paintings and a few antiques. The rest is history."
"Let's hope she pulls up the crappy carpet while she's at it," I remarked.
"Amen to that." Henry invited me in for a glass of wine, and I would have taken him up on the offer, but my phone started ringing. "I better get that," I said, and took off at a trot. I caught the call just before my answering machine picked up. It was Melanie Oberlin. She said, "Oh, good, I'm glad I caught you. I was afraid you weren't home. I'm just about to dash out, but I have a question for you."
"Sure."
"I called Uncle Gus earlier today, and I don't think he knew who I was. It was the oddest conversation, kind of goofy, you know? He sounded drunk or confused, or maybe both."
"That's not like him. We all know he's crabby, but he always knows exactly where he is and what's going on."
"Not this time. Maybe it's his meds. They've probably got him on pain pills."
"At this late date? That doesn't sound right.
I know he was on Percocet, but they pulled him off that as soon as they could. Have you talked to him lately?"
"Not since you left. But Henry's been to see him 2 or 3 times. If there was a problem, I'm sure he'd have mentioned it. You want me to look in on him?
If you don't mind, she said. After he hung up, I called back and spoke to Solana, hoping to get her assessment of the situation. She thinks he may be showing early signs of dementia.
Well, that's worrisome, I said. I'll go over in the next couple of days and have a chat with him.
Thanks, and could you ask Henry if he's noticed anything?
Sure. I'll get back to you as soon as I have something to report.
Tuesday morning, I set aside an hour to serve a 3-day pay-or-quit notice on a tenant in a Colgate apartment building. Ordinarily, Richard Compton, the owner of the building, would have delivered the eviction notice himself in hopes of goosing the renter into catching up. Compton had owned the property for less than 6 months, and he'd been busy booting out the deadbeats. People who decline to pay their rent can sometimes be a surly lot, and 2 had offered to punch his lights out. He decided it'd be smart to send someone in his place, namely me. I personally thought it was cowardly on his part, but he'd offered me $25 to hand someone a piece of paper, and it seemed like adequate recompense for 2 seconds worth of work. Traffic was light, and I made the 15-minute drive with my radio tuned to one of those talk shows where listeners call in to ask advice about marital and social woes. I'd become a big fan of the hostess and found it entertaining to test my reactions against hers. I spotted the street number I was looking for and pulled in at the curb. I folded the eviction notice and tucked it in my jacket pocket. As a general rule, in serving papers of any kind, I don't like to show up waving official-looking documents. Better to get the lay of the land before making my purpose clear. I hefted my bag from the passenger seat as I emerged and locked the car behind me. I took a minute to scan the premises, which looked like a movie version of a prison. I was staring at 4 3-story buildings arranged to form a square, with the corners open and walkways between. 24 apartments were lumped together in each unadorned block of stucco. Junipers had been planted along the foundations, perhaps in an attempt to soften the facade. Unfortunately, most of the evergreens had suffered a blight that left the branches as sparse as last year's Christmas trees, and the remaining needles the color of rust. Across the front of the nearest building, I could see a short row of slab porches, 1 step high, furnished with the occasional aluminum lawn chair. An apologetic inverted V of roof had been tacked above each front door, but none were large enough to offer protection from the elements. In the rainy season, you could stand there, house key in hand, as you fumbled to get in, and by the time the door finally swung open, you'd be drenched. Summer sunlight would beat down unrelentingly, converting the front rooms into small toaster ovens. Anyone climbing to the 3rd tier would suffer heart palpitations and shortness of breath. There was no yard to speak of, but I suspected if I went into the interior courtyard, I'd see covered barbecue grills on the 2nd and 3rd loggias, clotheslines and children's playthings in the grassy patches at ground level. The garbage cans were standing in a ragtag line at one end of the structure that housed empty carports in lieu of closed garages. The complex had a curious, unoccupied air, like housing abandoned in the wake of calamity. Compton had nothing but complaints about his tenants, who were sorry sons of bitches. His words, not mine. According to him, at the time he'd purchased the property, the units were already overcrowded and ill-used. He'd made a few repairs, slapped a coat of paint on the exterior, and raised all the rents. This had driven out the least desirable of the occupants. Those who remained were quick to bellyache and slow to pay. The tenants in question were the Guffeys, husband and wife, Grant and Jackie, respectively. The previous month, Compton had written them a nasty letter about their failure to pay, which the Guffeys had ignored. They were already 2 months in arrears and perhaps intent on garnering another rent-free month before responding to his threats. I crossed the dead grass, went around the corner of the building, and up a flight of outside stairs. Apartment 18 was on the 2nd floor, the center 1 of 3. I knocked. After a moment, the door was opened to the length of the burglar chain, and a woman peered out.
Yes?
Are you Jackie? A pause.
She's not here.
I could see her left eye, blue, and medium blonde hair caught up on rollers the size of frozen orange juice cans. I could also see her left ear, which had sufficient small gold hoops stuck through the cartilage to mimic a spiral-bound notebook. Compton had mentioned the piercings in his description of her, so I was reasonably certain this was Jackie, lying through her teeth. Do you know when she'll be back? What makes you ask? Now I was the one who hesitated, trying to decide on my approach. Her landlord asked me to stop by.
What for?
I'm not authorized to discuss the matter with anyone else. Are you related to her? A pause.
I'm her sister. I'm from Minneapolis.
The best thing about lying are the flourishes, I thought. I myself am a world-class practitioner. And your name is
Patty.
Mind if I write that down? It's a free country. You can do anything you want. I reached into my shoulder bag and found a pen and a small lined notebook. I wrote Patty on the first page. Last name?
I don't have to tell.
Are you aware that Jackie and her husband haven't paid rent for the past 2 months?
Who cares? I'm visiting. It's got nothing to do with me.
Well, maybe you could pass along a message from the guy who owns the place. I handed her the eviction notice, which she took before she realized what it was. I said, that's a 3-day pay or quit. They can pay in full or vacate the premises. Tell them to pick one.
You can't do that.
It's not me, it's him, and he warned them. You can remind your sister of that when she gets home.
How come he doesn't have to live up to his side of the deal?
As in what? Why should they be prompt when the son of a bitch takes his time about making repairs, assuming he gets to them at all?
She's got windows, won't open, drains backed up. She can't even use the kitchen sink. She has to do all the dishes in the bathroom basin. Take a look around. The place is a dump. And you know what the rent is? $600 a month. It cost $120 to get the wiring fixed, or they'd have burned the building down. That's why they haven't paid, because he won't reimburse them for the money they spent.
I can sympathize, but I can't give you legal advice, even if I had any to offer. Mr. Compton's acting within his rights, and you'll have to do that too.
Rights my ass. What rights? I stay here and put up with his crap, or I have to move out. What kind of deal is that?
The deal you signed before you moved in, I said. You want your side heard, you can join a tenants association.
Bitch!
She slammed the door in my face, at least so far as she could manage with the burglar chain in place. I got back in my car and headed for the notary's office so I could dot all my I's and cross my T's. Chapter 15. When I got back to the office after lunch, the message light was blinking on my answering machine. I pushed the play button. A woman said,
"Hello? Oh, I hope this is the right number. This is Dual Great House. I'm calling in regard to a flyer I found in my door yesterday. The thing is, I'm almost sure I've seen that gentleman. Could you give me a call when you get this? Thanks. Oh, I can be reached at..."
She rattled off the number. I snatched up a pen and a pad of paper and jotted down what I remembered, then replayed the message to verify the information. I punched in the number, which rang half a dozen times. The woman who finally answered was clearly out of breath.
"Hello?
Mrs. Greathouse, is that Dual, or did I misunderstand the name?"
"That's right. Dual, with a D.
Hang on a second. I just ran up a flight of steps. Sorry." "Not a problem. Take your time." Finally, she said,
"Whew,
I was on my way back from the laundry room when I heard the phone.
Who's this?"
"Kinsey Milhone. I'm returning your call. You left a message on my machine in response to one of the flyers I distributed in your neighborhood."
"I sure did. I remember now, but I don't believe you gave your name."
"Sorry about that, but I appreciate your calling.
I hope you don't mind my asking, but why are you looking for this gentleman? I wouldn't want to get anyone in trouble. The flyer said something about an accident. Did he hit someone?"
I went back through my explanation, making it clear that the man didn't cause or contribute to the accident. I said, He was more the Good Samaritan. I'm working for an attorney who's hoping he can give us a report of what went on.
Oh, I see. Well, that's all right then. I don't know that I can be much help, but when I read the description, I knew exactly who you meant.
Does he live in the area?
I don't think so. I've seen him sitting at the bus stop at Vista Del Mar and Palisade. You know the one I mean?
At City College?
That's it, only on the opposite side.
Okay, right.
I've noticed him because that's my street and I pass him as I'm driving home. I have to slow to make the turn and I'm looking in that direction.
How often do you see him?
A couple of afternoons a week for the past year, I'd say.
And this is since last May?
Oh, yes.
Can you tell me which days of the week?
Not offhand. I moved to my apartment in June of 86 after I took a new part-time job.
What sort of work do you do?
I'm in the service department at Dutton Motors. What's nice is I'm only 10 minutes from work, which is why I took this apartment to begin with.
What time of day would you say?
Mid-afternoon. I get home at 2:50, pretty much without fail. I'm just half a mile away, so it doesn't take me long once I'm on the road.
You know anything about him?
Not really. It's mostly what you said. He's got thick white hair, and he wears a brown leather jacket. I only see him in passing, so I really couldn't guess age or eye color or anything like that.
You think he works in the neighborhood?
That'd be my guess. Maybe as a handyman or something of that nature.
Could he be employed at City College?
I suppose it's possible, she said, sounding skeptical. He looks too old to be a student. I know a lot of older people are going back to school, but I've never seen him with a backpack or a briefcase. All the college kids I see carry something of the sort. Books, at the very least. If you want to talk to him, you might catch him at the bus stop.
I'll try that. In the meantime, if you see him again, could you let me know?
Certainly, she said. And with a click, she was gone.
I circled her name and number on the desk pad and put it in the file. I was excited to have even a sketchy confirmation of the man's existence, like a sighting of the Loch Ness Monster or the Abominable Snowman. The report gave me hope. I worked late that day, paying bills and generally getting my life in order. By the time I got home, it was 6:45 and fully dark. The temperature had dropped into the 40s from a daytime high of 62 degrees, and my turtleneck and blazer offered no protection from the wind picking up. The damp fog emanating from the beach amplified the chill. I knew once I was safely indoors, I wouldn't want to venture out again. I saw lights on at Gus's house and decided it was as good a time as any to pay a visit. I was hoping the supper hour was through so I wouldn't be interrupting his meal. As I passed, I saw the dumpster was half full. Solana was evidently making progress in her junk elimination project. I knocked on Gus's door, my arms crossed tightly as I huddled with the cold. I shifted from foot to foot in a vain attempt to warm myself. I was curious to meet Solana Rojas, whose work history I'd researched 3 weeks previously. Through the glass pane in Gus's front door, I watched her approach. She flipped on the porch light and peered out, calling through the glass.
Yes?
Are you Solana?
Yes.
She wore glasses with black frames. Her dark hair was the uniform brown of a home dye job. If she'd had it done in a salon, some artiste would have added a few phony-looking highlights. I knew from the application she was 64, but she looked younger than I'd imagined. I smiled and raised my voice, hooking a thumb in the direction of Henry's place. I'm Kinsey Milhone. I live next door. I thought I'd stop by to see how Gus is doing. She opened the door, and a slat of warm air escaped.
The name again is what?
Milhone. I'm Kinsey.
Nice meeting you, Ms. Milhone. Please come in.
Mr. Vronsky will be happy for the company. He's been a little down in the dumps. She stepped back, allowing me to enter. She was trim, but carried a bulkiness in the belly that spoke of childbearing once upon a time. Young moms often lose the baby weight quickly. but it returns in middle age to form a permanent mocking pouch. Moving past her, I automatically gauged her height, which was 5'2" or so to my 5'6". She wore a serviceable-looking pastel green tunic with matching pants. Not quite a uniform, but wrinkle-free separates bought for comfort and washability. Stains from a patient's blood or other body fluids would be easy to remove. I was struck by the sight of the living room. Gone were the chipped veneer tables with their tacky little knick-knacks. The stretchy dark brown slipcovers had been removed from the couch and three chairs. The original upholstery material turned out to be a pleasant mix of florals and tones of cream, pink, coral, and green, probably selected by the late Mrs. Vronsky. The limp drapes had come down, leaving the windows looking bare and clean. No dust, no clutter. The mouse-back carpeting was still in place, but a bouquet of dark pink roses now sat on the coffee table, and it took me a moment to realize they were fake. Even the smells in the house had changed from decades-old nicotine to a cleaning product that was probably called spring rain or wildflowers. "Wow, this is great. The place has never looked this good." She seemed pleased. "There's still work to do, but at least this part of the house is improved. Mr. Vronsky's reading in his room, if you'll come with me." I followed Solana down the hallway. Her crepe-soled shoes made no sound, and the effect was odd, almost as if she were a hovercraft floating before me. When we reached Gus's bedroom, she peered in at him and then glanced back at me and put a finger to her lips. "He's fallen asleep," she whispered. I looked past her and saw Gus propped up in bed, supported by a pile of pillows. A book was open across his chest. His mouth was agape, and his eyelids were as transparent as a baby bird's. The room was tidy, and his sheets looked new. A blanket was neatly folded at the foot of his bed. His hearing aids had been removed and placed close at hand on his bed table. In a low tone, I said, "I hate to bother him. Why don't I come back in the morning?" "It's entirely up to you. I can wake him if you like." "Don't do that. There's no hurry," I said. "I leave for work at 8:30. If he's up, I can visit with him then." "He's up at 6 o'clock. Early to bed and early to rise." "How's he doing?" She pointed. "We should talk in the kitchen." "Oh, sure." She retraced her steps and turned left into the kitchen. I trailed behind, trying to tread as quietly as she did. The kitchen, like the living room and bedroom, had undergone a transformation. The same appliances were in place, yellowed with age, but now a brand new microwave sat on the counter, which was otherwise bare. Everything was clean, and it looked like the kitchen curtains had been laundered, ironed, and rehung. In a belated answer to my query, she said, "He has good days and bad. At his age, they don't bounce back so quick. He's made progress, but it's 2 steps forward, 3 steps back. I gathered as much. I know his niece is concerned about his mental state. The animation dropped like a veil falling away from her face. "You talked to her?" "She called me yesterday. She said when they talked on the phone, he seemed confused. She asked if I'd noticed any change in him. I haven't seen him for weeks, so I really couldn't say, but I told her I'd stop in." "His memory isn't what it was. I explained that to her. If she has questions about his care, she should address them to me." Her tone was slightly testy, and the color had risen in her cheeks. She isn't worried about his care. She was wondering if I'd picked up anything myself. "She said you suspected dementia." "I never said any such thing." "You didn't? Maybe I'm mistaken. But I thought she said you'd mentioned early signs of dementia." "She misunderstood. I said dementia was one of several possibilities. It could be hypothyroidism or vitamin B deficiency, both reversible with proper treatment. I wouldn't presume to make a diagnosis. It's not my place." She didn't say you'd made any kind of claim. She was just alerting me to the situation. "Situation?" She was looking at me intently, and I could see she'd somehow taken offense. "Sorry, I guess I'm not expressing myself well. She said he sounded confused on the phone and thought it might have been his medication or something like that. She said she called you right afterward and the two of you discussed it. And now she sent you to double-check? On him, not on you. She broke off eye contact, her manner prickly and stiff. It's unfortunate she felt the need to have a conversation with you behind my back. Apparently, she wasn't satisfied with my account. Honestly, she didn't call to talk about you. She asked if I'd noticed any change in him. Now her eyes bored into me, hot and dark. So, now you're the doctor. Perhaps you'd like to see my notes. I keep a record of everything, which is what I was taught. Medications, blood pressure, his bowel movements. I'd be happy to send her a copy if she doubts my qualifications or my dedication to her uncle's care. I didn't actually squint at her, but I felt myself focus on the skewed exchange. Was she nuts? I couldn't seem to extract myself from the misinterpretation. I was afraid if I uttered two more sentences, she'd quit the job in a huff and Melanie would be up a tree. It was like being in the presence of a snake, first hissing its presence, and then coiled in readiness. I didn't dare turn my back or take my eyes off her. I stood very still. I let go of my fight-or-flight defense and decided to play dead. If you run from a bear, it gives chase. That's the nature of the beast. Likewise, a snake. If I moved, she might strike. I held her gaze. In that flicker of a moment, I could see her catch herself. Some kind of barrier had come down, and I'd seen an aspect of her I wasn't meant to see. A flash of fury that she'd covered up again. It was like watching someone in the throes of a seizure. For 3 seconds, she was gone, and then back again. I didn't want her to realize the extent to which she'd revealed herself. I moved on as though nothing had occurred. I said, "Oh, before I forget, I wanted to ask if the furnace is working okay." Her focus cleared. "What?" "Gus had a problem with the furnace last year. As cold as it's been, I wanted to make sure you were warm enough. You haven't had a problem." "It's fine." "Well, if it starts acting up, feel free to give a yell. Henry has the name of the heating company that worked on it." "Thank you. Of course. I better scoot. I haven't had dinner yet and it's getting late." I moved toward the door and I could feel her following at my heels. I glanced back and smiled. "I'll pop over in the morning on my way to work." I didn't wait for a reply. I gave a casual wave and let myself out the front door. As I trotted down the porch steps, I sensed her standing at the door behind me, watching through the glass. I resisted the urge to check. I took a left on the walk, and the minute I was out of her sights, I allowed myself one of those shudders that shakes you from head to toe. I unlocked my apartment and spent a few minutes turning on all the lights to dispel the shadows in the room. In the morning, before I took off for work, I made a second trip next door, determined to talk to Gus. I thought it was odd that I'd found him asleep so early in the evening, but maybe that's what old men did. I'd played and replayed Solana's reaction to my questions about Gus's mental state. I hadn't imagined the flash of paranoia, but I didn't know where it came from or what it meant. In the meantime, I'd told Melanie I'd check on him and I wasn't going to let the woman scare me away. I knew she didn't start work until mid-afternoon and I was just as happy at the notion of avoiding her. I climbed the porch steps and knocked on the door. There was no immediate response, so I cupped my hands against the glass and peered inside. There were no lamps turned on in the living room, but it looked like the kitchen light was on. I rapped on the glass and waited, but there was no sign of anyone. I'd borrowed the key Gus had given Henry, but I didn't think I should take the liberty of letting myself in. I went around to the back door with its glass upper section. A note had been taped to the inside. "Meals on Wheels volunteer. Door is unlocked. Please let yourself in. Mr. Vronsky is hard of hearing and may not respond to your knock." I tried the knob, and sure enough, the door was unlocked. I opened it wide enough to stick my head in. "Mr. Vronsky?" I glanced at the kitchen counters and the stovetop. There was no sign he'd eaten breakfast. I could see a box of dry cereal set out beside a bowl and a spoon. No dishes in the sink. Mr. Vronsky, are you here? I heard a muffled thumping in the hallway.
Hell and damnation! Would you quit all that hollering? I'm doing the best I can.
Within seconds, the querulous Gus Vronsky appeared in the doorway, holding on to a walker for support as he shuffled into the room. He was still in his robe, bent nearly double by his osteoporosis, which left him staring at the floor. I hope I didn't wake you. I wasn't sure you heard me. He tilted his head and peered at me sideways. His hearing aids were in place, but the left one was askew.
With all the racket you made? I went to the front door, but there was nobody on the porch. I thought it was a prank, kids making trouble. We used to do that when I was young. Knock on the door and run. I was on my way back to bed when I heard the ruckus in here. What in tarnation do you want?
I'm Kinsey, Henry's tenant.
I know who you are. I'm not an imbecile. I can tell you right now I don't know who's president, so don't think you can trip me up on that one. Harry Truman was the last decent man in office, and he dropped those bombs. Put an end to World War II, I can tell you that straight off.
I wanted to make sure you were okay. Do you need anything?
Need anything? I need my hearing back. I need my health. I need relief from this pain. I fell and put my shoulder out of commission.
I know. I was with Henry when he found you that day. I stopped by last night, and you were sound asleep.
That's the only privacy I have left. Now there's this woman comes in, pestering the life out of me. You may know her. Solana something. Says she's a nurse, but not much of one in my opinion. Not that that counts for much these days. I don't know where she's gone off to. She was here earlier.
I thought she came on at 3 o'clock.
What time is it now?
8:35.
A.M. or P.M.?
Morning. If it were 8:35 P.M., it would be dark out.
Then I don't know who it was. I heard someone fumbling around and assumed it was her. Doors unlocked. It could have been anyone. I'm lucky I wasn't murdered in my bed.
His gaze shifted.
Who's that?
He was looking past me at the kitchen door, and I jumped when I saw someone standing on the porch. She was a heavy-set woman in a mink coat, holding up a brown grocery bag. She motioned at the knob. I crossed and opened the back door for her.
Thank you, dear. I have my hands full this morning. I didn't want to have to set this on the porch. How are you?
Fine. I told her who I was, and she did the same, introducing herself as Mrs. Dell, the Meals on Wheels volunteer.
How are you doing, Mr. Vronsky?
She set her package on the kitchen table, talking to Gus as she unloaded the bag.
It's awfully cold outside. Nice that you have neighbors concerned about you. Have you been doing well?
Gus didn't bother to reply, and she didn't seem to expect an answer. He made an irritated gesture, waving her away, and moved his walker.